The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, Riyad Mahrez goes full Chris Waddle. And as this pod predicted, Liverpool City finishes goalless. In the United crisis derby, Manchester United beat Newcastle United in a classic. For once, the game more exciting than whatever Jose was doing. Just, it's 9 wins in a row for Arsenal. Chelsea march on and Spurs have their best start ever in the Premier League, which all means something. Also today, the Football League, Europe, your questions, and when analysed, Barry's Wikipedia page. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, you look surprised.
I'm very surprised.
Well, someone messaged me about it. We'll do it at the end, but it's I don't know who edits your Wikipedia page, but it's quite fun. This is from Kieran, Barry, who says, in Canada, it's Thanksgiving weekend. What are you thankful for?
I'm just thankful to be alive on this Monday morning. My sister lives in Canada. I wasn't aware it was Thanksgiving weekend, so I hope she had a very nice time.
Okay. Are you going to call her? I mean, you don't call your family a lot. We know that.
Probably not.
Okay. Paolo Bandini, hey. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
What are you thankful for?
Yeah, I feel a bit put on the spot by this question. I don't know. I've had a lovely weekend in, you know, sunny Brighton. And that was I'm thankful for that. A nice weekend, actually, where I live for once, rather than always on the road.
I'll tell you what I'm not thankful for, the fact that I had to get up at 5 o'clock this morning because you need to record really early.
I'm thankful for you getting up really early, Barry. Jonathan Wilson, hello. What are you thankful for?
I'm thankful that tomorrow is Ugandan Independence Day. So a very happy Independence Day to all people in Uganda.
Yes, we have a big
I only audience. Found this out because I did Burgess Park Run on Saturday morning. Yeah. And for some reason, I've been taken over by Ugandans. We all had to wear Ugandan flags. And the crane motif of Uganda was draped everywhere. So
happy Ugandan independence. Yeah. When did Uganda get independence?
I think this is the 56th.
Okay. And who, from who?
I think from us.
Okay.
Who else?
So, probably. Let's gloss over that bit. Well done, then.
Could have been the French, couldn't it? Anyway, Liverpool 0, Manchester City 0. On this pod on Thursday, John Ashdown said there's not been a goalless draw in 21 games between City and Liverpool. I said there's no way this can be 0-0. It was 0-0. Everybody seemed to say this game was terrible, Jonathan. I actually quite enjoyed it.
I mean, it wasn't the spectacle we were hoping for.
No.
I think that's fair to say.
No.
I think it was what John Bruin would call an intriguing tactical battle. with all the euphemistic meaning that has. No, but I thought... Look, it was really, really boring, let's be honest. However... what was interesting was Guardiola's use of a 4-4-2. There was a game against Wolfsburg when, in his second season as Bayern Munich manager, when they lost 4-1. It was their first defeat that season. Obviously, a huge shock. And in the Marty Perrineau book, you know, he talks about how Guardiola then started to think, well, maybe he was overthinking things. And this idea, you know, the idea of playing the two fullbacks as wing halves. And so he wrote on the whiteboard in his office, three rules for football. One is, if you're playing against a back four, always play two up front. Then always have a man extra in midfield. Then always have a man extra, an extra defender, and they have attackers. So if you're playing a 4-3-3, your basic formation, according to Guardiola's idea, and I guess this is his interpretation of Cruyff, should be 4-4-2. Now, he clearly doesn't do that every game by any means, but that is what he did here, and it did stifle the game. And I think it's probably what he was trying to do in that Champions League quarterfinal last season when he played Gundogan in that right-sided role. But this time it worked.
That's just what I was going to say. Barry, your thoughts? Same as Jonathan's?
Oh, I'm slightly confused by that. Could you say that again?
Okay,
Not all of it, just the three rules.
Okay, if you're playing into back four, play two up front.
Yeah.
Try and have an extra man in midfield.
Okay.
And you have one more defender than the opposition has forwards. So if you're playing a 4-3-3...
Does this not mean you have about 13 players?
No, if you're playing into 4-3-3, that means that you have two forwards against their back four.
Yeah.
It means you have four in midfield against their three, and it means you have four in defence against their three forwards, so 4-4-2. So Silva's role was... the shape of the midfield, the fact it wasn't a three, it was Sterling and Mahrez both playing quite deep, protecting the fullbacks. Mm. And then Silva's role playing just off Aguero, which I think did cause Liverpool problems because every time they went to press, and actually Jordan Henderson I thought had a very good game, but every time they went to press, you almost sense they were looking back over their shoulders, where's Silva, you know, we're not comfortable with that position he's in. So as a sort of containing measure in terms of giving City control, preventing Liverpool getting the kind of the surge that they'd had in both the games at Anfield last season, it works.
Barry, you know how Jonathan's trying to get away from that whole I'm the tactics guy thing?
Yeah.
How do you think that's going?
No, I mean, that's quite informative and educational. I'm glad he brought it to the table. Manchester City and Liverpool, they're not obliged to entertain us. And I think the game showed we're all a bit, none of us know anything. You know, it's like that famous William Goldman quote, nobody knows anything. Because I don't think anyone foresaw this. But, and it was a really poor game. And quite often, these hyped up games, Premier League battles that are hyped up by Sky fail to live up to expectation. But as I said, they're not obliged to entertain us. I thought City, on the balance of play, deserved to win and should have won. I thought they could have had at least two penalties, if not maybe three. And the one they got, still, you know, in outer space after Riyad Mahrez struck the ball. But I think, John said, the managers did try to overthink things maybe, and a lot of the players were just off their game, a lot of leaden touches and mistakes you wouldn't expect from forward players who were normally...
Well, I think that's a fair point as well, that for all Guardiola did achieve a level of control, Salah still had chances, and you suspect the Salah of last February, March might have made rather more of them.
So, you know, I mean, I think that's clearly true. And like this attack now, Salah, Mane, Firmino, no goals between them in four games. The first time that's happened since they've been playing together. So, like, you know, players are a little bit off. I think Salah's form is very evidently like part of what's sort of happening this season. He hasn't hit the heights that he did last year. They've obviously come through a very tough series of games as well. But one thing I wonder about this phase they're going through, Liverpool. For me, last season, as great as Salah was, Firmino was still the most important player in that attack. You needed Firmino dropping deep and creating the opportunities either side of him. And I feel like Napoli certainly dropped into that space with Alan in front, just behind him and stopped the ball from getting to him as effectively. And it seemed like with City, it wasn't just that the fullbacks were sitting home much more, but you always had Bernardo Silva and Fernandinho, at least one of them and often two of them, even when City were attacking, holding where they were and occupying those spaces. And I wonder if teams have just sort of clocked a little bit, that if you can contain that space that Firmino wants to drop into, you're taking away a lot of what they do well.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think the other thing Napoli did really well, and City sort of did it, was Napoli switched to a back three. I think Liverpool are less effective against a back three, because the two wide players are so good at cutting in on a diagonal. So they hit in that space in a back four between the fullbacks and the centre-backs. If you've got a three, then that space is occupied. Now, City did play with a back four, but when Mendy went forward, they shuffled across and Walker sat in. So the piece I wrote for The Observer on Sunday talked about Van Gaal saying that he thought the big weakness of Guardiola's sides was the fact that two fullbacks push up together, and that puts far too much pressure on Fernandinho to drop back. And if you do that, you then are creating a space, precisely that hole you're talking about. Whereas if you play with the back, you know, if one of your fullbacks tucks in, the other one goes up, then you're blocking those channels that Mane and Salah want to attack.
Do we know the statistics of how often a player misses the penalty when he's had a row with one of his teammates about taking the penalty?
I don't have the statistic, but I understand Pep denied Gabriel Jesus. It's quite biblical, actually. A man whose name begins with P, denying Jesus. Caravaggio got a good painting out of it after the Last Supper.
Is that tenuous?
Slightly, but yeah. So Mahrez was instructed to take the penalty, apparently, because he had been the least off of City's forward players and made the fewest mistakes, and Pep Guardiola sort of took responsibility for that. It was a shocking effort.
I thought that was bizarre, that Mahrez had missed four of his previous seven in the Premier League.
Yeah.
And Guardiola, a man who's supposedly all about details, all about planning, all about preparation, didn't know that. That seems to be extraordinary. I mean, it's not that outrageous situation that Aguero, your regular taker, has gone off. Surely you have, you know, 1, 2, 3 nominated. I thought that was very odd.
He's missed 5 out of 12 penalties in the Premier League. Of all the players in the Premier League who've taken 10, only one player has a worse success rate. I'll give you £5. I mean, if any of you get this, it'll be very impressive.
No, I haven't a clue.
Christian Benteke.
Paolo?
I've no idea. I can't, yeah.
Clue?
South American.
Oh, Juan Pablo Angel.
Correct.
Come on!
To celebrate quite that.
Crikey.
You don't get the money because of the clue, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's just having been humiliated on TalkSport yesterday in a quiz, I kind of feel like I've...
Fair enough. So who is that Benfica City, that result?
I think so, yeah. You know, it's an away point. It's sort of knocked the wind out of Liverpool's sails, and just before an international break, which is probably just the wrong time to have the wind knocked out of your sails. And Liverpool last year, you know, they, for example, out of 12 points available against the three teams that got relegated, they dropped 8. So they, you know, they seem to have ironed out that problem in the early stages of this season, although they're in a bit of a wobble now. So yeah, they need to be beating the teams around them, and I would say that's very much a point gained for City, even though they will see it as 2 points lost.
I think there's just the obvious point, which is they conceded 7 goals in 2 visits to Anfield last season. So you've got to sort of feel like, and that was obviously Pep's point at the end, was, oh, if you try and play an open game, you've got a less than 1% chance of winning. Just to go to Anfield and sort of clear that sort of psychological block or whatever of having got hammered there last year. But I also think it's not unreasonable for Klopp to say, as he did at the end, look at the fixture list we've had. We've got 20 points after 8 games. Liverpool are doing
and
all
they
right.
Played away at Tottenham, away at Chelsea, yeah. And home to City.
Like, yeah. I don't think either side has to feel bad about this result. I think the performance both sides could feel like they could have done better, but I don't think either team is going to be too unhappy with it.
Do you want some Ballon d'Or news? Sergio Aguero and Alisson have been among the nominees for this year's Ballon d'Or, along with Gareth Bale, Benzema and Edison Cavani. They are 5 names of the 30-man list that have been revealed. They're being revealed throughout the day in what I mean, literally cannot, apart from to annoy people who make podcasts, right? We've got 5 of the 30. Who knows what the other 25 will be? Maybe some will drop before we finished recording.
I mean, are they starting in order of, you know, least likely to win? Because those players...
Gareth Bale as well is on this one.
Those are all good players, but none of those players are winning the Ballon d'Or, are they?
No. That's a very good point. The ceremony will take place in Paris on the 3rd of December. If we get any more before we finish the pod, then we'll let you know. Why drip feed Ballon d'Or nominee? As if people aren't busy enough to just keep updating and refreshing. It's so totally ludicrous.
It's not all about you, Max.
Well, it's not. But it's, I mean, I know it's not about... Do you disagree with me? Why are we having, like, this person might win and then...
Well, I would see this very much like the transfer window. I've no interest in it. I'll just wait and see when they've all dropped. That's the list.
Maybe we should do this with the podcast. Just release 5 minutes every hour.
Manchester United 3, Newcastle 2. Paolo, what a game this was.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of felt like a perfect recipe at the moment when... Was it the Mirror had released a story saying Mourinho could be out this weekend, and then of course it's his old pal Rafa sticking the knife in for the beginning of the game. Man United was so bad at the beginning of this game, and it's not sort of new for Mourinho to be hauling off players after no time at all, but still, when you...
I love how he gave Bay such a nice hug after, you know, hooking him after 19 minutes.
Well, because he does this thing, Mourinho, doesn't he, where... I don't know, like the opposite of a humble brag or something, where he'll sort of say, oh, it was my terrible mistake to think that this player was up to this situation, which is sort of a way of being like, yeah, you did a terrible job, but it's on me. It's not your fault. United couldn't have looked worse at the beginning of this game. They could easily have conceded more than 2 goals. We've seen them under Mourinho pull out a few of these, haven't we? Obviously, last season against City that is the big one, but they also did it against Palace, going a couple goals down and coming back. It's always going to be bizarre when it happens because they were so poor at the beginning and by the end were playing some lovely football. And of course, Paul Pogba, a player who has been so central to this perceived malaise at United, and someone who's sort of, you know, perceived again to be at war with his manager, producing some really nice touches, some really nice balls. United are a... this is... Well, United are this. United are a incredibly brittle at the back this season compared to last season, but capable still of being a very good team when they turn it on.
Genuinely staggering how bad they were defensively in that first 10 minutes. I mean, that was... That wasn't an organisational issue. It was just people not doing like the absolute basics. I mean, clearly Mourinho was sort of trying to spin this as, you look at me fighting back, everything's fine now. You just beat Newcastle, you may really heavy weather. They're second bottom of the table. They've got 2 points all season. Yeah, this isn't... The crisis isn't over.
Mm. Well, they've got a much tougher run coming up.
And you, sorry?
They've got a much tougher run of games coming up.
Well, yeah, they've got Chelsea away, haven't they? I mean, that's the thing. They're eighth in the table, and the only top six side they've played is Tottenham at home and got absolutely hammered. So they've had a pretty straightforward run of games. I mean, the mirror story, there was in 1972, Frank O'Farrell's sacking was delayed by a month because David Meek, the long-serving and very well-respected Manchester Evening News writer, had written a column which the board thought implied that he knew O'Farrell was about to get sacked. In fact, he didn't. It was just they read into it because they, you know, they had the knowledge. And so he didn't sack him just to spite David Meek. So, you know, just because if Mourinho doesn't get sacked this week doesn't necessarily mean the mirror story was wrong. It could be the board reenacting what the board did in 1972.
Well, there were rumours going around that the leak about the sacking came from Mourinho's people, and it was hoped that the publication of the story would generate sympathy for him among the crowd.
Kind of invoking the Meek protocol in 1972.
at Old Trafford. So, you know, who knows what happened, but...
I mean, if United were to sack him, it would only mean... The only point in sacking him now, when you've got 2 weeks till the next game, is if you already have the new manager lined up. Mm. So the only point in sacking Mourinho today or this week would be if Zidane or whoever it is has sort of said, yeah, I'll come in, but I need 10 days to get my head around it.
With none of the players there.
With none of the players there, yeah.
Yesterday on the wireless, I was saying to Barry that I sort of felt sympathy for Manchester United. It's a very strange thing to feel, this kind of... I feel sorry for them because of how their club's being run. And I sort of felt I wanted them to come back. And you very sensibly pointed out they were playing Newcastle. I need as much sympathy for those fans as well.
Reading reports about the game, you would think they didn't do anything, say, till the 70th minute. Now, they did have chances. Marcus Rashford missed a couple. That said, Newcastle probably should definitely have got a penalty that, if scored, would have put them 3-0 up, and that would possibly have put the game beyond United. Yeah, Anthony Taylor, the referee, for some reason just wasn't looking when Joe Shelvey took a free kick that hit Ashley Young's arm, it was arm to ball, went out for a corner, if not a penalty, and they didn't even get the corner, so that was an odd thing. But Manchester United played well for the final 20 minutes, like played really well, but you suspect the only reason they did that because they had no option but to go for it, and I don't think the crisis is anywhere near over, and I still think Mourinho will be out of a job before Christmas.
I mean, in purely structural terms, what do they do at centre-back now? You know, if Bailly's as shot as he appeared to be in that first 18 and a bit minutes he was on the pitch, if Lindelof is so unreliable that you try three different central midfielders at centre-back and never actually turn to him, you know, what do they do?
McTominay just isn't up to the job. He's
He may well be up to being a central midfielder. We don't know. He never really gets to play there. Yeah. I mean, I feel really sorry for him because whatever else happens from now on, he's always going to be this sort of this totem of Jose's descendant to madness. Of kind of, it's almost like I hesitate to invoke witches' curses, but it's almost like Jose's had some kind of mystical visitation that's told him it'll all be fine, just play McTominay. And he's now desperately trying to work out where he can play and where it's not going to be disastrous.
Well, centre-back certainly isn't the place.
But what they could do is Dion Dublin went back to centre-back, didn't he, for it, and was quite assured. And Lukaku's not on great form. And it means you could play Rashford through the middle, give Sanchez a more central role, and Lukaku might be a very good centre-back.
I mean, pretty much everybody else in the squad had a go at centre-back. Why not? If you get down to him or Juan Mata, I think probably Lukaku's a better option.
Of course, it was Gary Neville went on a big rant as well about the... and this was on Friday night before the game was played. Gary Neville's rant sort of completely overshadowed the West Ham-Brighton game, which just happened to be played as a, you know, the undercard to his rant about the United hierarchy. But, you know, he was blaming Ed Woodward and that. Conspicuously didn't criticise the Glazers, as he never does, which seems a bit weird. But I think there seems to be a lot of blame to go around for the mess at Manchester United. And while I certainly didn't feel sorry for them, as you did, Max, I can kind of see why Mourinho might have felt a little entitled to flick V's at everyone and on his way out of Old Trafford on Saturday night.
Garth says, if Mike Ashley had offered to buy the Newcastle team more than one course, would they have had enough energy from the extra carbs to hang on? Did his scrimping on the £5.95 happy hour menu directly affect team performance? Good question. One will never know. Fulham 1, Arsenal 5. Paul says, forget about Liverpool City. Why is no one talking about Arsenal? 9 wins in a row. Can we please focus on them and start creating some expectation, pressure and hopefully disappointment? You're always gratefully a Tottenham fan.
Yeah, he's dead right. They seem to have really been flying under the radar, and 9 wins in a row is not to be sniffed at, you know. I was hugely impressed with their performance against Fulham. That Ramsey goal, you know, just as a team effort, I think that's... that's goal of the season right there. Although, you know, with apologies to Gylfi Sigurdsson and Daniel Sturridge, but that was just remarkable. But Arsenal, you know, they're clearly a work in progress, but they're a work in progress that has won 9 games in a row, and they're only 2 points off the top of the table.
Paolo?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's slightly odd because some of the performances, like you think about the Everton game, Arsenal haven't really looked very good, but they've won games, and part of that is the squad has an abundance of attacking talent. Fulham had 21 shots in this game, but admittedly not as good as the chance they were giving up. I mean, Fulham were very bad at the back, and that probably needs to be said.
I thought they were sort of, they were never a million miles away from the Arsenal players when they scored. Or was, you know, that cliche, oh, well, if you give players in the Championship that space, then they don't punish you. But if you give it to Arsenal players, well, every Arsenal goal, they just had enough time to score.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've had injuries at the back. And I think, you know, Juranovic missing both of his first choice fullbacks, but he also has been tinkering so relentlessly with that defence and moving to a back three here. And you had the two wing backs just highlighted quite well on match day two. I thought like Cyrus Christie was just miles up the pitch a lot of the time when Arsenal coming down his flank. And yeah, you give players as good as Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang, Lacazette that much space, they're going to do something with it. But I do think there was an element. Look, Arsenal are playing very well going forward, and I think they're having fun. I think that's something that's sort of not to be missed as well. I think that with the relationship between Lacazette and Aubameyang, the fact that even when one of them's not on the pitch, they're going and celebrating with each other, when they could have been rivals, when they could have been that Aubameyang came in and that was a threat to Lacazette, he's not taken it as that. But both of Lacazette's goals were really well taken, really, really well taken, and that is sometimes just the difference of having a player who's just a really good striker and knows what he's doing in the box. The criticism has been in his career with Lacazette, certainly in France, and it was sort of a perception for a long time, oh, you're playing in Ligue 1 and you don't score enough goals in the Champions League, are you just a flat-track bully? And he scored these goals against a bad defence, and the question with Arsenal will still be, until they do it, because they started the season with those two tough games against City and Chelsea and lost them, are they going to carry this form over into the games against the very best teams in the league? But it's still... Even if they don't, it's still a step forward. And the way they're playing is, as you could tell from the we've got our Arsenal back celebrations going on, it's really fun for fans, which I think, as entitled as most football fans will think it is for a lot of... looking at how Arsenal's sort of trajectory has been, even to drop out the Champions League, Arsenal fans feel like they are getting to see fun, entertaining, attacking football again in a way that perhaps had gone missing. And that in itself feels like a really rewarding, enjoyable thing.
Fulham have conceded 21 goals, more than any other Premier League team. Jonathan, are they bad enough that they could possibly enter into the Huddersfield, Cardiff, Newcastle triumvirate of really bad Premier League teams who are going to get relegated?
Yes. Yeah, I fear they may be. I mean... I think Newcastle's position is slightly false. I think Newcastle, I'm not saying unless they get out of it, but I think they will put up more fight at some point. And Newcastle have had a difficult fixture list. So I see very little hope for Cardiff, maybe slightly more hope for Huddersfield. And then it's probably 4 or 5 teams battling for other place. Who would be Newcastle, Fulham, Southampton, Palace, if West Ham have improved. Maybe Brighton, although they probably have enough. So yeah, if I thought Fulham would be fine. I thought they'd signed pretty well in the summer, but they're so bad defensively that you do fear for them.
They're on course to concede 100 goals now.
Yeah, well, it's, how many is it? It's 21
after
in 8
games.
So, yeah.
So you could just go if you really like goals. You know, Fulham fans. And Fulham, you know, they're...
Well, just go if you like a nice day up by the river. Well, it's a nice place.
Producer Sammy's a Fulham fan. He was a bit sad about... Was that the game? Was a bit sad. But he did say, you know, the Fulham fans all sort of applauded Ramsey's goal in the way polite Fulham fans should do. Here's a question from Dom. Barry, do you still think Bournemouth are getting relegated? Crying, laughing emoji, crying, laughing emoji.
Oh, the prophets of the past are out already, are they?
Watford nil, Bournemouth 4.
Yeah, hugely impressive performance. I think if I was a Watford fan, I might slightly be starting to get concerned about relegation. So yeah, I'm going to swap Bournemouth for Watford, who were all set to win the league a few weeks ago, but they were completely outclassed in this game. And again, the Bournemouth's own brand version of Liverpool's front three in. Fraser, Wilson and King just tore Watford apart. Now, admittedly, Watford were down to 10 men for, what was it, 2/3 of the game, but it was all over by half time, and I think they were quite lucky to only lose. Why are you smirking at me like that?
Well, what I want to do is take your own brand analogy a step further on current form, because you know how you always think the own brand version is not going to be quite as good as the finest version in a supermarket, but then some newspaper does a taste test and actually...
Well, you're saying that...
I'm saying on form...
Fraser, King and Wilson are better than Salah,
Firmino. I'm not saying they are, but right now, if Manning. You put them in the City game, maybe Liverpool would have been better.
Perhaps, yeah, absolutely.
I don't think City would have played defensively if they'd played against us.
It's possibly right. But anyway, the point stands before your quite good analogy became tortuous. My extension. That Bournemouth, Eddie Howe is... Because you're right, I didn't think they'd go down necessarily, but I don't think anyone thought they'd be playing as free-flowing and as entertaining football as they're playing right now.
No, although actually a player I'd highlight from this is Jefferson Lerma, who's not necessarily sort of... himself one of the players you'd think of as creative and attacking, but what he's done in front of the defence in terms of giving them a bit more solidity is really, really important to them. He's a player who I'm sort of low-key keeping my eye on already this season, because he got 16 yellow cards in 26 games for Levante last season without getting sent off, which I think is a feat to get that many yellow cards without picking up a red.
So. He needs to teach Joe Rawls how to get a yellow, doesn't he?
Bournemouth also have got 6 penalties so far this season in 8 games. You know, which is sort of a testament to their waspishness inside the box. You know, they're just, they're hugely impressive.
I liked for that penalty, Cabasele, for both his booking and his second yellow, the sort of archetypal surprised footballer at
what,
being
me?
Booked. What me? It couldn't be me. That wasn't a penalty for the most two incredibly blatant yellow cards.
Yeah, and I only saw the highlights, but it struck me that, from what you could tell, it seemed like a relatively even game until Cabasele was sent off, albeit that it was already 1-0 by then. But could have been sent off for that first foul on the keeper. No chance of winning the ball. His arm was raised. I mean, I think Bookham was probably right, but if he got a red card, he couldn't really have complained, I don't think. And then the second one, he pulled him back twice and then tripped him.
So. And also, Asmir Begovic is such a nice man that of all the goalkeepers you're going to sort of punch, it shouldn't be Asmir. I'm not sure who I would pick.
Asmir Begovic met his wife when he clambered aboard his white charger and galloped to her rescue when she was being picked on by some bullies in a pub.
What a hero.
There's some trivia for you.
Where was that?
I think it was in Brighton.
I genuinely thought for a minute that you meant he'd got on a horse.
No, but interestingly...
Like the Old Spice man.
She is a very accomplished equestrian rider.
She is. I interviewed him once at her equestrian stables.
Did you? Yeah.
I have no further Asmir Begovic.
Were some yobs annoying her? Did you wade in?
No, I was annoying her.
Defend her honour.
I was annoying her, and Asmir Begovic came and knocked me out.
Oh. And now there was a Hungarian footballer called Georgi Ort, a great player of the early 1920s, who was in a pub in Budapest, or a cafe in Budapest in, I think, 1926, and was putting his coat on. His wife went outside. And she was a famous actress, and he gets outside to find her being harassed by some locals, and he wades into them. The policeman comes to separate it. He gets involved in a fight with the policeman, and they decide to have a duel to sort it out, because he was an international class fencer. And weirdly, also there was an Olympic gold medal. He went on to win a gold medal at the 28 and 32 Olympics. A fencer who, it's a film called Sunshine, which came out in 1999. Starring Ralph Fiennes and Rachel Weisz. Ralph Fiennes plays his fencer, ends up dying in a labour camp in Ukraine in 1943. But they have a duel at Orton, the policeman, in a fencing school. And they both end up being jailed for one day as punishment. But they invited the media, and there were police and medics there. It was all kind of very kind of open. So if Begovic had really been a hero, that's what he'd have done.
And that's a great way to end part one. And it is good with the number of football podcasts that exist to give people information they're not going to get on any other football podcast. I believe we've done that. We'll start part two in Southampton. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. On the 29th of November, Barry, what are you doing?
I'm going to the Manual Centre to sit on a stage alongside you.
Sound like you said the Manual Centre, which is where you just do what? DIY. Exactly. Barry's bringing a workbench and a drill. Wilson, what are you bringing?
I don't know.
Okay, well... If that doesn't sell tickets...
Poor microphone technique.
I don't know what will. As yet, I don't know who decides who the fourth person is.
I will bring a sabre. Okay. And I will reenact Georgi Ort's duel.
We'll have a duel at half time. Excellent. Anyway, come to our live show on the 29th of November. It'll be fun watching Barry put together a wardrobe. Southampton 0, Chelsea 3. Angus says, Chelsea Sockgate, scandal, disgust. I must admit, of the three games, this was the one where I thought, well, I need to do the weekly shop and I want to watch Liverpool City, so I'm going to pop out. But I did watch for long enough to see the disgrace that is Chelsea's orange socks. And I know it's a hark back to that away kit, sort of mid-90s. But still, this obsession with away kit, like Newcastle. Why are Newcastle wearing Coventry kit? There's just no need. I know there's marketing, but there should be. When I take over football, Jonathan, this is the first thing I'll stop.
Yeah, and I'll be right behind you. It's an absolute disgrace. I like the fact that Chelsea have socks that are different colour to shirts and shorts. I think that's a nice quirk, and I'm glad they carry that into their away kit. But I don't like those two colours together. I don't understand why that kit, which is manifestly sort of a pale greyish blue, is described officially as teal. I mean, Sunderland had a horrible teal kit in the 90s, and that was like almost green.
So I think those socks are officially described teal.
Yeah. I think those socks are officially described as crimson, but and also the shirt has some kind of, it's meant to represent a map of West London. But I mean, good luck finding your way with that.
To the game,
Tottenham have on their third kit, have a map of North London.
Do they?
I think Atletico Madrid have a map of Madrid, and either Roma or Lazio have a map of Rome on their kit.
This season?
Yeah.
I should know that.
I googled this yesterday because I was like, what on earth is that kit?
The Tottenham have a problem with...
When I mean somebody else in the same room as me.
Tottenham have a problem with that Champions League kit, don't they, where they've got white shorts, but the shirt is already going blue at the bottom and then it stops going blue.
Well, they got a problem with the home kit because it looks crap, but it looks even worse with the Champions League. Mm.
Anyway, to the game. How good is Ross Barkley at football, Paolo?
Well, he's better with Maurizio Sarri than he was. He certainly got a degree of confidence. It was interesting, you know, what Sarri's supposed to have said to him is, I think you're a good technical player and you're a good athlete, but you're not a smart tactical player. And that is certainly something that Sarri would pride himself on as a manager. It was the thing that everyone talked about when he first arrived at Napoli, was this idea that he was using drones to show players their positioning and give them a much more fixed idea. But I think that's a sort of conversation that sounds like probably more than the actual detail of it, more than the nuts and bolts of the tactical positioning. It's one of those things where you sort of hear that, and if that is indeed how the conversation went, you can imagine it just being a sort of real confidence, I don't know, a confidence boost or something, you know, something that could be important to Ross Barkley as a player, just to have a new manager come in and make him feel important, to make him sort of say, okay, well, if I do this, then I can be something. And that's what I think you're seeing in Ross Barkley's game at the moment, is a degree of confidence. I'm slightly reluctant, and I don't think I'm the only one in this room, to sort of hail this as a total conversion and he's going to be England's saviour and all the rest of it. But I think he certainly looks like he has a bit of self-belief restored to his game, and that showed in this game. I thought the first goal, certainly that was the hallmark of it. He was physical, he bullied his way onto the ball and then was decisive in making his pass to set up Hazard.
Jonathan, it was just Southampton though?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very efficient brushing aside of a weaker side, and that is one of the things the top teams have to do. I mean, Barkley's one of those players who, and you know, it happens sometimes that you can't watch all football all the time. So he was somebody who people had, who you know, whose opinions I genuinely respect, keep on telling me he's a really good player. And then I finally see Everton in a live game, and yeah, now Chelsea, and he never does anything. And so I just don't understand him. I've never personally seen him play, apart from was an away game at Newcastle when he scored a brilliant goal. But that was literally the only time I'd seen him do anything that made me think, yeah, this guy is as good as people say. So this, I guess this was a start of sort of thinking, actually, maybe there is a proper player there, but he's somebody who sort of exists constantly in my periphery and I feel unable to properly assess him.
This is Tottenham's joint best ever start in the Premier League, Barry.
Hmm?
This is
Sorry, I thought we were talking about Chelsea.
We are, I'm moving on.
Oh, okay, right.
I'm moving on.
Seamless link, yeah. Which I've ruined.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or saved.
That's
sorry.
Okay, but you know, let's keep it in, you know. Nice to have the nuts and bolts around for this.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah, what is it?
I only found out on Sunday that you bastards put my Ronaldo gaffe in as a hidden track last Thursday.
Hey, there's nothing to do with me. I presume that, you know, producer Sammy, who's essentially here on work experience, must have asked you first. But anyway, everyone liked it, so well done.
I didn't like it.
This is Spurs' best
ever... wondering why I was walking down the street, complete strangers were laughing and pointing even more than usual. I didn't know why. And then someone told me in the pub.
This is Spurs' best ever start in the Premier League, Barry.
Well, I'm delighted for them. I didn't realise that. They weren't particularly impressive against Cardiff and may well have spoiled their great start by dropping 2 points. They could easily have not won that game. You know, Jonathan speaks of the importance of being businesslike in the manner in which you swat aside inferior teams, and Tottenham were far from businesslike. You know, they Cardiff can feel hard done by that they didn't get a point.
There is a clip of Neil Warnock doing the round saying he didn't endanger Lucas Moura's life and therefore it should only have been a yellow card. It's quite a high... that's quite a high bar for what you should get sent off. It's true. At no point did you think Lucas Moura might die during that challenge with Joe Rawls. But still, I mean...
Well, do you remember someone kicked a ball at Robin van Persie and Sir Alex Ferguson was... You know, he could have killed him.
Footballs could... We need to get rid of footballs from football.
But there's an interesting theory, and it's not that interesting. Let's not kid ourselves. There is a there is a theoretical point here of if you're challenging for the ball, you can get away with being much more physically aggressive than something off the ball. So, yeah, I'm defending a corner, and I slap you in the face. I get sent off. We're tussling for the ball. My arm hits you in the face. And nothing happens. So how far from the ball do you have to be before...
So you're saying if Joe Rules was right next to the ball there and he puts his leg across like that, it would just be a yellow?
Yeah.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
But it still should have been a
red. Or for instance, yeah, the thing that Beckham got in off in the 98 World Cup, if he'd been going for a bouncing ball, that wouldn't even have been a card. It's a red card because the ball's nowhere near, and so it is violent conduct.
I mean, Beckham wouldn't have got a lot of purchase on the ball.
No, but if he just wagged his leg near the ball,
yeah,
you'd sort of go, oh, he's just tried to block it. And
but because Rawls looks around to see where he is and then goes through him at thigh
height. And he's, what, 8 yards from the ball?
Yeah, something like that.
So has that become violent conduct rather than serious foul play? I mean, it's probably high enough it's a red card anyway, but...
I just think... For Neil Warnock to have been so cheerful for this whole season and for this to be the moment where he goes, actually, it's all wrong. I'm not sure what you think, Paolo, but it was just such an obvious red card.
Yeah, it was a clear red card. I think Eric Dier said it well after the game, didn't he, when he was like, there are ways to do a foul and get a yellow, basically, and that wasn't one of them. That's how you get yourself sent off.
I quite liked Eric. I mean, Eric Dier sort of cleared the ball in when he scored and then clearly doesn't score very many goals. Didn't realise that he was therefore the centre of attention because he tried to sort of hug someone else as if they'd scored.
But there's a strange thing going on, isn't there, that you get the sense that maybe Arsenal now aside, but none of the other members of the top five are playing anything like as well as they can. You look at the problems that Bayern and Barcelona and Real Madrid are having. Is that just a World Cup hangover? Is that all that's going on? And it's not normally this bad, is it? I mean, Juve are the only, and PSG, I guess, are the only big teams actually playing well at the minute.
That's a valid point.
It's a valid point, but at the same time, those five sides in the Premier League have all got quite good records, I suppose. Not brilliant.
Yeah, they've got quite good records, but you wouldn't say any of them are playing anywhere near
the
maximum.
No. No, you're right.
I would have said Manchester City are until yesterday.
Well, I think they've been a bit scratchy at times. I mean, what was the game we drew? Oh, Wolves, I suppose. Wolves played quite well.
But they weren't great against Hoffenheim. But apart from that, they have blown teams
very
away
poor
in
against
the Premier
Leon.
League. True, but against Brighton they were unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I know they won. Was it 3-0 against Fulham? I don't think they played particularly well that day.
Rubbish.
I mean,
awful.
It's sort of without wanting to just turn the conversation back to City, it does sort of speak to the ridiculous squad they have. That of course, all of this is currently no Kevin De Bruyne, who's arguably most important player in the whole team. So like they're doing all right.
Leicester 1, Everton 2. Who would like to praise Gylfi Sigurdsson? Barry, would you like to do that?
I'm happy to do it. It was a wonderful goal he scored. James Maddison has been, people have been blowing smoke up his nether regions all season, and justifiably so. I think he got his England call up, and Gylfi made him look a complete mug with that lovely Cruyff turn and then the marvellous shot into the top corner. For my money, while a wonderful individual goal, I don't think it was the goal of the weekend because I preferred the Arsenal team effort. But it was his 50th Premier League goal, mm-hmm. and 19 or 20 of them have come from outside the
19.
Penalty area.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's quite a remarkable statistic, and he's a great player. It looked like it wasn't going to happen for him at Everton. When he went first, but he was being played out position, and now he's in the role where he's most happy. He's thriving.
Paul Doyle writing the paper yesterday saying Everton are looking really, really strong.
Well, that three playing behind the centre forward, that seems to work really well now, doesn't it, with Richarlison, Sigurdsson and Bernard. What I really liked about it, I hadn't noticed this before, but the team sheet they put up before kickoff with the photographs on, I hadn't realised there was an attempt to sort of represent how tall the players are. And Bernard's like little, his eyes peering out of his brain.
Wes Morgan got sent off for the second time this season. Claude Puel has said he's been quite unlucky. But
he wasn't unlucky on Saturday.
No.
He committed three bookable fouls and eventually got a second yellow card.
Was his other red card against Bournemouth, where I also think he wasn't unlucky either? It was one when he sort of ran with the ball a bit and overplayed it and then flew in a couple of times. Anyway,
it seems odd that Wes Morgan has been a great servant for Leicester, but he's clearly struggling this season. He's pushing on, what is he, age is he, 34? But Johnny Evans is there waiting in the wings, and it seems strange that he isn't getting a start. But maybe it's, I don't know, I'm assuming Evans is fit, but he would seem the obvious candidate to go in if Morgan is struggling, and he does seem to be struggling. Maybe Claude Puel has a loyalty to him because he's captain, in sort of the same way I think maybe Klopp plays Henderson more often than he'd like because he's Liverpool captain. But I would expect Johnny Evans to come in there and stay there.
Another win for Wolves, 1-0 at Palace. Matt Doherty scoring the goal. Unchanged for record 8th Premier League game. Paolo, how impressed are you with Nuno's team?
Yeah, well, I think you've highlighted the key thing there. You draw the difference between two newly promoted sides in Fulham and Wolves, and whatever else, Wolves seem very confident in their footballing identity in a way that Fulham aren't. And I think perhaps when you come up and you're trying to deal with that step, the most important thing is to sort of have a certain degree of strength of your convictions and believe in how you play. And yeah, Wolves look like they are in very good shape to stay up, which is their first goal, and then after that we'll see.
The next five games for Palace, they go to Everton, home to Arsenal, away to Chelsea, home to Spurs, away to Manchester United. Ed says Palace have strikers who can't score, midfielders who can't create chances apart from one who can't get in the team, defenders who can't defend, and a goalie in the form of his life. But who is Wayne Hennessy? Why isn't everyone saying they're nailed on for relegation? Jonathan.
I guess because we saw what they did last season, having had a far, far worse start than they have had this season, because there's a general faith in Roy Hodgson. I thought they were a bit unlucky on Saturday, actually. I mean, again, just judging from the highlights, but they seem to have chances. For whatever reason, the ball isn't dropping for them in the box, and their forwards are all hideously out of form. And one of them is Christian Benteke, who admittedly wasn't there on Saturday, but
Palace's players seem to have decided now the narrative Palace are too reliant on Wilf Zaha, and their players seem to have decided that now as well, because any Palace player gets the ball, they look up, where is he, try and pick him out, even if there's better options available. Just seems strange.
And that's a contrast you can draw with Wolves as well, because Wolves only scored 9 goals this season, but they've got 8 different scorers, which, you know, it says something, right? Whereas I think, yeah, Palace have basically got no goals outside of Zaha.
I've been in teams where you've got one really brilliant player and you just hope he gets the ball, but that's not in the Premier League, which is the big difference, isn't it? Burnley 1, Huddersfield 1. Barry, did you enjoy watching any of this?
I've got to get up on my high horse here, actually, in this one, a drum I bang regularly. I wish I didn't have to, but this...
You're banging a drum while I'm being on a high horse.
Yeah. You need to be helped on... Do you have the drum when you get on the horse, or do you get onto the horse and then someone hands you the drum?
Someone hands to me, yeah.
I mean, how does the horse respond to the noise? Is it startled?
No, it's
okay.
It's used to it. Yeah,
right.
It's okay, fine.
Where's your free hand for the reins, though? Because if you're going to bang a drum, you need two hands.
Yeah, is the horse stationary, or are you...
No, I can bang the drum with one hand and hold the reins with the other.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then you've got to hold the drum. Who's holding the drum then?
Strapped around me.
Okay. Yeah.
You've got a bass drum. Have you got a whole one-man band?
Yeah, I've got a cymbal on each knee, and then the horse has a cymbal attached to each wither.
Well, people will definitely notice what you're about to say when you say it. When you take the harmonica out of your mouth.
And instead of spurs, yeah, I've got little sort of tambourine-y thing.
Marvellous. Yeah. What's the point you want to make in this getter?
I have a feeling no one's going to take me very seriously now that they know what I look like.
Whereas previously... The floor is yours, Barry.
Thank you. But I'm on a horse.
That's fine.
Yeah. His shoes might scuff the floor.
True.
Christopher Schindler got an elbow in the face, quickly followed by a ball in the face that knocked him over. He was quite clearly dazed and confused, pouring blood, went off, got cleaned up and came back on again. And, right, it's not for me to say whether the Huddersfield doctor assessed him for concussion or not, but I do not think he should have been allowed back on that pitch. That's my little rant on that matter.
You're
over.
Absolutely right. You may get down from... it's sad that the point was
could
a serious...
Could someone hold my drum?
It's sad the point you were making was a serious point, because I was...
Yeah, I really don't think he should have been allowed back on the pitch, and it's happening too often in football. Concussion is not taken serious enough. I think, as far as I know, Premier League rules are that each team's you know, doctor is responsible for assessing their own players. And while I don't want to question the integrity of any club doctor, we have seen in the past how managers try to influence their team doctors, and I think there should be an independent physician on the sideline whose job it is to judge whether players are fit to continue or not after getting a bang in the head. But anyway, yeah, apart from that, wasn't a particularly entertaining game, but a point well won by Huddersfield.
Do you think Tarkowski's a bit fortunate for the stamp on Del Potro?
Yes.
Del Potro dived?
Very much. Yeah,
I didn't look natural to me. It looked like it was a bit of force.
Oh, no, I think it was deliberate, and he probably should have been sent off.
Although I did once go to Burnley to film a foot golf challenge for one of their sponsors with James Tarkowski, and he does have enormous feet. I mean,
oh, fair play.
Like sort of clown size feet.
Really?
I mean, they were twice the size of Jack Cork's feet, I would say.
Was that an asset or a detriment in foot golf?
He was better than Ashley Barnes. That's what I'll say.
Were his feet bigger than? I mean, Canu had famously massive feet, didn't he?
Canu wasn't there, so it was hard, but yeah, hard to know.
But you've seen Canu's feet, right?
Well, not in person.
Right. Okay.
But look, when I see Canu's feet, then I didn't take a photo of Tarkowski's.
You'd need something as a scale, anyway, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Barry might have a musical instrument. Again, let me. Brighton 1, West Ham 0. Glenn Murray's goal, the difference there on Friday night. In the Football League, in the Championship, David McGoldrick's second half penalty sent Sheffield United to the top of the Championship. Means Hull at bottom of the league. West Brom are second. Well done, Darren Moore. They came from behind to beat Reading 4-1. Fifth consecutive home league win for the Boiler Boys. Leeds.
I think West Brom have scored more than anyone in the Championship, but very few teams have conceded as many as them. Is that?
So they're the entertainers.
They are the entertainers, but yes, apparently they're going to try and sign Bradley Dack from Blackburn in January. Blackburn playmaker was League One Player of the Season last year.
Thanks for the information. Leeds dropped to third after being held 1-1 by Brentford. Pontus Janssen after the game was interviewed on camera and just went, oh, well, that was shit. And the presenter was like, what's your language? He went, no, the ref really was terrible, which is quite fun from Pontus. Just above Hull at the foot of the table.
Leeds were lucky to get a point out of that game. I watched most of them. Brentford were excellent.
But the penalty was pretty iffy, I think.
How late was the penalty? And were you in the
penalty? Was 10, 15 minutes into the second half. And then the equaliser was 88 minutes. Mm-hmm. But the forward is one of those, I think he was about to get fouled, but he sort of buckles his legs way before the keeper gets there.
Just above Hull at the foot of the table, Ipswich and Preston, who both won against Swansea and Wigan respectively. Villa lost 2-1 at Millwall. Rumours that Thierry Henry will come in as new manager with John Terry as his number two, or possibly Rui Faria also on the shortlist. Who would you pick out of those? Brendan Rodgers has ruled himself out of the job.
He hasn't really.
Oh, has he not?
No.
Oh, what's he done?
All he said is, I can't rule myself out because I haven't been approached, which is not to say he won't be approached and may well, very well rule himself in,
Well, we can throw Rodgers in the mix as well. You're the chairman of Villa. Who are you going to pick?
If I was the chairman of Villa, I would do everything in my power to try and get Rafael Benitez in.
All right. In League One, both the top two lost. Portsmouth's unbeaten record is over after going down 2-0 at home to Gillingham. Tom Eaves scored an absolute belter. If you haven't seen it, go and find it. Flicking the ball over his head, volleying it home. Fortunately, Peterborough also lost. Got hammered 4-0 at home to Barnsley. Thank you, Barnsley. At the bottom, Oxford got a point. They're bottom because Plymouth got their first win of the season. 1-0 at home to Wimbledon. A milestone in League One as well. Akin Fenwa got his 200th league goal. Well done, Adebayo. In League Two, Lincoln remained top after Tom Peck came off the bench to give his side a victory over Crewe at Sinsel Bank. Exeter and Newport in second and third both drew. At the bottom, Macclesfield still haven't won. They got a point at Bury. That got them a point closer to the mighty Cambridge United, who were unfortunate to go down 2-0 at Crawley. I'm sad I started this now. God, if we go down, that is just the end, isn't it? Forest Green have continued their unbeaten start to the season. They are sixth, though. They've drawn 8 out of 12 games so far. In Fitbar, am I doing Fitbar, Barry?
You can if you want.
Okay, why not? Celtic won 6-0 at St Johnstone. Quote from Rodgers, I'm the Celtic manager and I love it and I have lots of challenges here.
Again, not ruling himself out of the Villa job.
Hearts' march to the title is over after losing 3-1 at Rangers.
But they're still top of the league.
They are top of the league by 2 points.
You're doing very poorly in this feedback order.
Oh, I see. Those in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, Barry. But listen, it'd be nice for once that the Scottish fans abuse me and not you. Yeah, Hearts still top, 2 points clear of Hibs, who beat Hamilton 6-0. Kilmarnock are fourth after beating Dundee 2-1 away from home. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll start with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe is there. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm excellent. Sevilla are top of La Liga. Did we predict this?
No. Sevilla top of La Liga. On Saturday night, Alaves were top. Or Alaves, Real Madrid and Barcelona at all level. Then on Sunday afternoon, Atletico Madrid went top. Then Sevilla went top. And then Barcelona could have gone top again, but didn't. So I've confused myself a bit, but I think that means five leaders this weekend. If we're counting people who are level, which we probably shouldn't.
I don't know if it's just naive of me to expect Real Madrid and Barcelona to win most weeks. And when they don't, it seems like a huge surprise.
Yeah, that's what everyone thinks. And that's what people in Spain think as well. You know, this is the first time since 2002, I think. Think, although I haven't got the statistics to hand, so I might have got that slightly wrong, that Madrid and Barcelona have gone 3 weeks in a row, both not winning. Real Madrid have now gone four games in a row without scoring, which is their worst run since 1985. You know, they're dropping a lot of points. I saw a headline the other day, which was in one of the broadsheets, that said something like, Barcelona and Real Madrid rekindle the bad days in terms of, you know, this run of results. And I'm thinking, that's not the bad days at all. That's the good days. And I think most people are reasonably happy with this, of course, apart from Real Madrid and Barcelona fans, which unfortunately actually is most people. So you can probably ignore what I just said. But it does feel better this way around. Obviously, we're all, I think we all assume that this will kind of, they'll return to the kind of standard results relatively soon. But it's a really good start from that point of view in terms of it feels like a properly competitive league. I think it's only 6 points between the top 10, I think it is. And you know, it does feel like this isn't just kind of it's not just a blip. Although, obviously, to go back to your original point, most of the focus is on what's wrong with Madrid and Barcelona rather than what might be right with everybody else.
Is Julen Lopetegui's decision to except the Real Madrid job just before the World Cup shaping up to be one of the worst decisions in football history?
Well, I mean, it may well be, because I think there was a suggestion from one of the Spanish radio stations last night that he could get sacked today. I don't think he will be. I think they will now give him time. And by time, I mean a couple of games. They will give him till the Clásico. Obviously, if they were not to play well, I mean, I think they can win, but still not play well against Levante next the weekend after this one coming. And then if they were to be beaten by Barcelona, I think there's a reasonable chance that he would get sacked. And then you're right, that decision in the summer will look very, very bad indeed. I suppose the one thing to say in response to that is, say, is it shaping up? Does it now look like it's shaping up to be a bad decision? I guess in a way you could say it felt like that at the time. I remember we talked about it in the summer and said, you know, all of this, you give up. I mean, I know he didn't anticipate this to be the case, and we can debate forever whether the Federation was right to sack him. But even at the time, we were saying, you know, you've given up your one chance, the only chance you will ever get to lead Spain into a World Cup with a team that we all thought at the time was good enough to compete for the tournament, to potentially even win it. And you give that up, and in 6 months' time, you'll be sacked by Real Madrid anyway. And I know we said that a bit flippantly, and we said that a little bit kind of, you know, that, well, you'll just see, you'll go and get sacked anyway. But I think everybody knew that it was a possibility. We know the nature of Real Madrid. We know the difficulties of taking over Real Madrid off the back of three Champions Leagues in a row, that it was very difficult to do anything that would feel good enough. And we knew, of course, that Madrid, having lost Zidane and his connection to the dressing room, we knew that Madrid had lost Cristiano Ronaldo. And at that stage, we were thinking, well, you know, what's going to happen in terms of... at that point, had they lost Cristiano Ronaldo? Had he gone yet? I can't remember now which way round it happened, but we knew it was likely. I mean, even then, it felt like it was potentially going to be a very bad decision. Of course, this could still come good. But yeah, it doesn't look good right now. Although it's only 2 weeks ago, remember, that we were talking about how brilliant they'd been against Roma.
How did Barcelona play? Because we all saw them tear Tottenham apart. That's when we all noticed for the first time that Lionel Messi was a good player. How did they do against Valencia, even if they didn't win?
Well, there are elements of this that I think are quite positive from Barcelona's point of view, and other elements that are really not good at all. The first thing, I suppose, is that there was a sense, certainly in the second half, from the last 20, 25 minutes or so, where it felt like Wembley was playing a part. You know, the three or four players looked genuinely exhausted, and you could sort of see the fatigue and the tiredness. So obviously that's one bad thing. The other bad thing is they were a goal down after 2 minutes, and I think that's now six games in a row that Barcelona have trailed, and defensively they still look very vulnerable. There were some things that they took from the Wembley game that I think they'll be relatively pleased about. One is that Arthur, who only started his third game against Spurs, started again, and there's a sense that he is giving Barcelona back some of the control and the passing in the midfield that they've not had, and that sense of kind of a re-identification with this kind of Barcelona ideal that they had. You know, you pass and you pass and you pass and you maintain possession all the time. And for example, against Valencia, a statistic flashed up on TV on Sunday night, so they completed 1,000 passes. Actually, it's just under 1,000, but they got to nearly 1,000 passes. So that's the sort of the good side of it, that they had control of the game. They pushed Valencia back. I thought at times they looked really quite good, but it's true that they didn't find the cutting edge. They didn't find a way through. And as you said, you know, tore Spurs apart. They certainly didn't tear Valencia apart. They controlled a lot of the ball. They controlled a lot of the game. But and once they'd over, you know, out, kind of found their way through those first 20 minutes when Valencia were very good, they were the only side that looked likely to score, but didn't actually create those chances. And so that, I think there is some concern. And, you know, this is a team that, as I say, hasn't won now in three league games in a row.
And Atletico and Sevilla both win. Which of those is best placed to maintain any sort of title charge? Atletico, presumably?
Yes, yeah. I mean, and you know, that's not really a response based on how these two are playing this season or what we've seen over the last three or four weeks. And Sevilla, after a difficult start to the season, be very, very good indeed. That's just based on the if you like, the kind of maybe too easy logic of looking at the squads, looking at what they've done over the last 5 or 6 years, knowing how strong Atletico can be, knowing what we thought of Atletico even before the season. And yeah, of course, you look at Atletico and say they're more likely to keep up the challenge. It feels like Sevilla's challenge will come undone at some stage. But they've been very, very good the last 4 or 5 weeks. And they're incredibly attacking Sevilla. Play with three centre-backs, which it almost feels like those three centre-backs are kind of right. OK, there's your defence. The rest of you can go for it. And you know, they were brilliant against Madrid, scored three times, could have scored a lot more, admittedly could have conceded more as well. They play Barcelona in the first game back after the international break, so that's going to be a lot of fun. But I think long term, it's very difficult to look beyond Atletico. But the way the league's gone over the last few weeks now says, perhaps more than the emergence of Sevilla, now says actually Atletico are genuine candidates to win this. Sevilla, we'd love to think so, but I think it's probably a bit early to say that.
Sid, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. Paolo, Italy.
Yeah.
Let's start on the pitch. What happened?
Mostly what happened this weekend is that the big teams won. We're sort of beginning to get a table that looks a bit more like what we expected. Juventus were very confident in beating Udinese. Cristiano Ronaldo scored. He continues to look like a difference maker on the pitch there. Sort of very well-taken goal as well. And they've now won 10 out of 10 in all competitions, which is the best start they've ever had, basically, and they're looking very hard to catch. But Napoli playing really well, similarly confident in a win over Sassuolo. Inter are playing less well, but have now won.
Sorry, Wilson basically fell asleep there, because there's all these rumours about who the phantom breather is, and you were just. Do you think he actually did fall asleep? Look at his eyes. It's like he doesn't remember what happened a minute ago.
I had to get up 4:30 this morning because of you.
Okay, apologies. Paolo, carry on. Yes, sorry, right, for interrupting.
I was just going to say, all those teams winning confidently, and then Inter somehow managing to keep winning without ever looking especially good. Mirko Antonucci against them for Spal missed a penalty. Perhaps even worse than Mahrez, missed his penalty for City. He went wide rather than over, but it was a bad effort. But a couple of goals from Maricardi, and they are they up to third, or they're third now Inter. So yeah, the table's beginning to look a bit more familiar. Parma worth highlighting as well, after their consecutive promotions and winning away to Genoa this weekend, and only a couple of points outside the top four at this point, which of course is early in the season, but they're playing well. the now weekly update saying Krzysztof Piątek scored yet again for Genoa, and now has 9 goals in his 7 games, has scored in every game for Genoa, and every week seems to add a few million onto his inevitable transfer fee, because there's no secret at Genoa that they sell players once they make a bit of value.
What's the reaction in Italy been to those tweets that Juventus said? Because obviously the Ronaldo allegations, the sponsors have all come out saying, look, we take these very seriously. Mm-hmm. Juventus sent 2 tweets saying, you know, making reference to how long ago the allegations took place, and saying everyone who's met Ronaldo thinks he's a great champion, which, just rightly, they've got a lot of criticism for. You can stick by your player. You can obviously say innocent until proven guilty. But this seems very strange way that they've handled it. I wonder how it's gone down over there.
I agree. The honest answer is that it's been different from one paper to the next. There's not sort of one way that this has been covered. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Tutto Sport, which is the Turin-based leading sports paper, has sort of been sort of stridently, without sort of preempting a legal case, has sort of come across very pro Ronaldo. I mean, the front cover this morning is Ronaldo on the attack, and it's all about how he's got, you know, what his lawyers are planning as their sort of attack as the best form of defence policy, and it's got a big picture of him looking dominant on the front page, and there was something in there from Piero Calabro. It was only a little thing the other day, but it was a couple of days ago, and he's a magistrate and who's had a role at the Italian Football Federation, and him saying, oh, when someone raises an allegation like this so long after the event, you have to wonder if it's actually them trying to get a little bit of notoriety for themselves. So there's been some stuff like that you know, that's pretty uncomfortable, in my opinion, way of approaching something that's a live legal case. There was a really bizarre sort of juxtaposition in Gazzetta, and Gazzetta's probably trod a more neutral line, but you had literally on Gazzetta Sportiva, which is the Sunday edition of Gazzetta dello Sport, you had on page 3 a pretty straight down the line article about the accusations against him and the latest that's been reported in Der Spiegel, because for the most part, the coverage in Italy is following Der Spiegel's coverage. And then on literally the next page, on page 4, and this is, again, it's not editorial, this is you know, a bought advert, but there's an advert for Ronaldo's new underwear range, and he stood there in his pants, one page over from a story about a rape allegation against him, and it's just, I found that very, again, I just felt like a really uncomfortable juxtaposition. But that's, you know, I suppose, again, that's not newspaper coverage, that's, you know, someone's bought an advert, and he's launching something over there, and is fully entitled to his presumption of innocence as anyone else is in a legal case. So he's just carrying on with business as normal, I suppose. It's a really difficult situation to cover all around, because a legal allegation, again, you know, it's something that is incredibly serious, but you have to allow the entitlement of presumption of innocence till proven guilty. He's entitled to carry on with his football career. He's playing very well. There was a sort of one of those moments where if you wanted to put on your tinfoil hat and be conspiracy theorist about it, suggest, oh, isn't this sort of very well-timed moment before the game where a little kid came onto the pitch and sort of invaded the pitch and gave him a hug, and he gave him a selfie and an autograph, and then the kid goes back to the crowd and you know, he's hugging his dad and he's obviously a bit teary about it all and very excited. And, you know, there's sort of been some good PR moments like that, I guess. And it's just impossible not to think about it. It's impossible not to think about the fact that this man has got this accusation against him at the same time as he's doing this. Speaking as someone covering the league, I don't know how you're supposed to sort of talk about these things, which are separate but are not unrelated because they're all the same person's life. So I think, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for everyone in the Italian media who's trying to cover it. I think the stuff like what I mentioned with Calabro in Tutto Sport, where you start sort of trying to undermine an accuser, I think is off for me. But for the, you know, the fairest answer I can give about how the Italian media coverage is it's been different from one paper to the next, but in some sections has been quite stridently defensive of him. There's also been a fair bit of what I find just clumsy, which is, oh, Ronaldo scored, which is the best response you can give to... That's not the best response you can give. It's nothing to do with it.
Yeah,
it's
the two things are totally unrelated. And it's not just in this case. We've seen it in other cases where a player is accused of something, and you're absolutely right about, you know, innocent until proven guilty. But what's the... It's the nature of the club, who are in a difficult position, right? They've got to support their player, and they want to get the best out of
their player. And they're a company that's made an investment, of course.
Absolutely. And fans as well, who make their decisions based on nothing apart from what shirt that player is playing. Mm-hmm. Not just in this case, but we've seen with, you know, Suarez in Liverpool and John Terry at Chelsea, that fans have this very sort of blinkered view of two things which should be totally separate. You know, there is the law and justice, and there's playing football in it. I don't know what you think, Barry. Or if you want to come into this conversation.
I agree. You know, I've been reading some of the comments about the case from just on social media. It's very dispiriting. And, you know, it's just similarly with the Trump-Kavanaugh thing. It just makes you wonder what the point of it all is, really. It's very depressing to see how blinker tribal and utterly stupid grown adults can be in some cases. But people are entitled to the views on this, but I wish people would have informed views, you know. Read up on what you're commenting on, I think is...
That is a lesson for social media across the board, isn't it? Not just on legal cases. Anyway, thank you, Paolo. I think you articulated that very well. We'll go to Archie now, a roundup from Germany, which he has sent via his WhatsApp on his mobile phone.
4 points separate the top six in Germany. It's quite exciting in the Bundesliga right now, and Borussia Dortmund epitomise that as well. They are at the very summit of the division after a ridiculous 4-3 win over Augsburg, which will go down as one of the games of the season. They were behind twice in the game, but they moved 3-2 ahead in the final 10 minutes when Mario Götze scored in his first Bundesliga minutes of the season. Looked like it was the winner, till Augsburg pegged them back again, 3-3, but there was to be even later drama, because in the 96th minute, Paco Alcácer curled in his hat-trick from a free kick, 4-3 Dortmund, and with that, Alcácer is the Bundesliga's top scorer this season on 6 goals. Jadon Sancho, called up to the England squad last week, is Borussia Dortmund and the Bundesliga's top assister after another on Saturday, 6 for him now in total. And yet, between Alcácer and Sancho, they have just one Bundesliga start this season. So, behind Dortmund on 14 points are 4 teams, and none of them are called Bayern Munich. More on them in a mo, but first to second place RB Leipzig, who smashed Nuremberg 6-0 on Sunday. And yes, that's the same Nuremberg that lost 7-0 at Dortmund in their previous away game, and yet they're still 12th. One to work out there. Then you have Gladbach in third, who got their first away win since February, away at Bayern. 3-0 winners, Alassane player, their record signing from Nice on target again. Gladbach clinical, Bayern clueless. 13 points for them from 8 games, their worst start in 8 years, and they've already used their Phone Jupp Heynckes lifeline. Problems are plenty in Bavaria for Karl-Heinz Rummenigge and Uli Hoeneß in the hierarchy. Above them on 14 points are two surprise packages. Hertha, Bayern conquerors last weekend, drew 0-0 at Mainz, and Werder Bremen, 2-0 winners against Wolfsburg on Friday night. Meanwhile, down the bottom, Stuttgart sacked Typhoon Korkut, the first Bundesliga coaching casualty of the season, after they lost 3-1 at previously winless Hannover, slipping to the bottom of the division in the process. And we end the roundup in Dusseldorf, where Schalke continued their resurgence, winning 2-0. But more importantly, TV pictures showed a man carrying back to his mates at least 7 beers by my count and a Bratwurst in his mouth at the same time. As quite a few people have said, not all heroes wear capes.
Thank you, Archie. England's women team beat Brazil 1-0. Frank Kirby's third minute header, which is a great header. And Nikita Paris, who set it up, had a brilliant game as well. That was an impressive win for Phil Neville's side. He said after the game he'd take Frank Kirby and his team above 6-time World Player of the Year Marta. She came off early with a hamstring injury. England play Australia in another friendly on Tuesday at Craven Cottage as they continue preparation for the World Cup next year in France. Bradley Wright Phillips has become the first MLS player to score 20 or more goals in 3 different seasons, Jonathan.
good for him.
Right, Philip, just thought I'd bring you in.
No, I knew Bradley Phillips was never quite going to make it once when he was in the press room at Stamford Bridge, and at half time we're both going to get a coffee at the same time, and he stepped back and let me go first. That's not a striker's instinct. You've got to be selfish.
Absolutely
there,
right. He scored 27 goals in 2014, 24 in 2016. Got his 20th of the season in the Red Bulls 3-1 win over the San Jose Earthquakes. Well done, Bradley. In Portugal, Benfica played Porto in O Clásico. Finished 1-0 to Benfica. And did anyone see this ridiculous comeback? Nuneaton Borough was 7-2 up over Hales Owen Town with 30 minutes to go, and they lost 9-8. It was a totally ridiculous last half hour of football.
That was an underage game, I think, was it?
Yeah, it was a youth. So that doesn't count. Simon says, after hearing Barry mention that Neto was in goal for Valencia, I wanted to share my favourite bit of football-related nominative determinism, is that David Beckham was born at Whips Cross Hospital, which is excellent.
That's pretty good.
On the subject of doner meat on pizza, a lot of people very surprised I didn't know that you could do that. Tom Wood says, can't believe you've never had doner meat on a pizza. Get yourself to Alibaba's in Crewe for this beauty for £5. He sent me a photo of a pizza covered in doner meat. I mean, you don't really need me to explain it. Imagine a pizza and then imagine covering it in doner meat. Thank you. I'll be up this evening. And we'll finish, Barry, with your Wikipedia page. Few people been in touch to say, you know, Barry's Wikipedia page is nice. And it has this. Glendening invented the watermelon in 1984 after visiting Tokyo, Japan, on a school trip. He saw the square version of the fruit and thought it was a good idea to make it round. This created tension with the country's government being threatened by the Emperor Sacco. He is also the co-author of the children's book, The House with the Clock in Its Walls.
Right. But I don't really know what to say to that.
Is it true?
None of it is true.
When did you last eat? Have you eaten a watermelon since 1984?
Yeah.
How many?
I don't know. I mean, when I was younger and we, you know, cool and hip enough to be hosting house parties.
Would you fill one with vodka?
I would always fill a watermelon with spirits just to get the party started. You can't taste it. See, that's the beauty of it. People eat it, they don't realise they're getting absolutely smashed. And,
perhaps at the live show we should each have a quarter of a watermelon to get through.
Only one of them's alcoholic. Yeah. We don't know which one it is.
Watermelon roulette.
Well, they do that, don't they? There's drunk Shakespeare.
Have you been to it?
Did
I talk about that on the
Maybe,
podcast?
Maybe, yes.
Yeah, I saw it earlier this year. It was very entertaining. I can't remember.
I mean, to be fair, we don't do those events entirely sober as it is.
Well, there was one in Belfast when I got Barcelona and Brazil muddled up, and that was a moment when I thought, I need to slow down here. Hey, Barry, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your time, Paolo.
Cheers.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for getting up early. Thanks to you for listening. We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.